Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. As promised, Dr. George Delgado with us this hour for our pro-life open forum. Dr. Delgado is the medical director of Culture of Life Family Services. I'm getting hand signals. I'm apparently putting him on the air. Let me just tell you something, fellas. If I put him on the air, we're going to hang up on him as soon as the first call comes in. So be careful of that. Dr. Delgado, are you there with us? No! All right. Dr. George Delgado, are you there with us?
I'm here.
All right. We don't have Darren in the building with us, so it's an exciting day today of figuring out how to work the phones. Thanks so much for being with us. I am very happy that we're talking to you on this day where there were arguments in front of the Supreme Court regarding Roe versus Wade. I wonder if you saw any of it, heard any of it, or have any reaction to it.
Well, actually, I'm in Washington, D.C. right now, and I was standing out in front of the Supreme Court early this morning with us about close to 100 doctors and a couple of thousand other people that were the pro-life people outnumbered the pro-abortion people clearly, and it was really a very, very exciting day.
Oh, wonderful. See, I didn't know that either. I'm so glad that you're there and that all those doctors are there, and I noticed something today, and you may already have been familiar with this, but I watched coverage on and also listened to and read the coverage in various places, devoted a little time to figuring out what had gone on, and I don't want to surprise you if you weren't aware of this, but I don't think the American media is actually fair and balanced when it comes to the pro-life position.
Really? Are you sure about that?
It didn't seem to me that they heard the same arguments that I heard or came to the same conclusions about them.
Yes, exactly. The spin is going on very quickly. I think the people who support abortion are starting to get even more nervous after hearing these arguments.
Yeah.
And I think they know that their time has come and things are going to be changing in our country.
From your lips to God's ears, I hope that that is in fact the case. I think that many people are going to be surprised if Roe versus Wade is overturned, that in their state, say they live in New York or California or a similar state, nothing's going to change. But then if they live in Mississippi, for example, which this case is about, then a great deal may change. Our fight won't be over, in other words. But we'll at least have an even playing field on which to argue about and debate about and make reasoned arguments about what the law should be.
Right, exactly. And these these legal arguments that supported Roe v. Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood is really a house of cards, and it's time for that house of cards to be tumbled so that things can be decided with correct jurisprudence, and things can go back to the states. And you're right, the different states will react differently. There are about 12 states right now that have trigger laws that would be triggered if Roe v. Wade were abolished. So we'll see what happens there. There are several scenarios, of course. There could be a scenario where they keep the status quo. There's another scenario where they eviscerate Roe v. Wade, which is my hope and prayer, because, again, I think this whole issue of abortion being a right to privacy, and privacy was really an invented right. It's not in the U.S. Constitution. And then there's another possible scenario where they could uphold the Mississippi law, but not abolish the whole right to abortion. And
yes,
so that would kind of be a middle road. We'll see what happens. But, of course, that, in a way, I think is the Supreme Court would be kicking the can down the road, because then there'll be another state that passes a law. Well, there'll be the Texas heartbeat state.
Yep.
Well, first of all, they'll right away be challenged, and so they'll just have to hear it again and again.
That
so hopefully they'll resolve it once and for all.
Yes, and I thought, in all the kind of pregame reading about it, almost everyone on right, left, and center who are legal experts said the people to pay attention to are Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett. And from their questioning, as someone who's not at all expert in the law, although I did watch a lot of Perry Mason as a kid, the sense that you got was, these two are about to overturn Roe versus Wade. They were not even in the ballpark of let's keep a 15-week law.
Right, yeah. So that was very, very hopeful. And we'll see how they actually end up voting and where Justice Roberts lands, of course, too. But even if Justice Roberts goes with the more pro-abortion wing of the court, there's still a chance for sure.
Yes. I didn't see this reported much in the media that I consumed after listening to the arguments, but it seemed to me that the pro-choice side was not arguing about this is, in the text of the Constitution, you can find this or anything like that. They were simply arguing, look, the court has already decided this. Don't take it up again. It said that, I mean, the stare decisis was probably said more than, the word and in the statements today. So it didn't seem to me there were strong legal arguments. It seemed like the legal arguments all had to do with, oh, this has already been decided. So let's move along and not keep coming back to this.
Yes, it was clinging to precedent, and especially Justice Sotomayor and Justice Breyer, feeling that, well, what are the people going to think of the Supreme Court if we overturn a precedent? Well, there's precedent for that, the Dred Scott case, school desegregation. We've gotten it wrong before, as one of the speakers said in front of the Supreme Court, and we've corrected, and now it's time to realize that we got it wrong this time, and it's time to correct again. And that's happened again and again in the history of our country. And that's what's beautiful about our country, is that we can rechange our course and go back and look at the Constitution and then correct errors that have been made. And clearly, this was an error that was made.
Pro-life open forum this hour with Dr. George Delgado. If you have a question, Dr. Delgado is a physician. He's trained in several specialties, including end-of-life care. He's also an ethicist trained by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You're welcome to call with your questions about the proper treatment of life in its earliest stages, in its latest stages, wherever life, wherever human beings encounter challenges of disability or threats to life throughout the course of life. You can call and ask your questions, whether scientific or ethical. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I promise not to monopolize Dr. Delgado, and we'll get to your calls. But I got one more I wanted to ask you about. It seemed to me that Justice Sotomayor, in one line of questioning that she pursued today, was of the view that the only reason anyone would be pro-life would be because that's their personal religious inclination. That is, in other words, it's a religious thing. And that you're just, in essence, trying to impose your religion on others. As a physician, as a scientist, as someone who has, published scientific articles and whatnot in the journals, what do you make of the idea that only religion would be the only thing that would make you pro-life?
Yeah, that's utterly and totally false, and that's a common argument to marginalize people. Since religion has been kicked out of the town square in recent history, because if you look at the simple embryology, it's clear that a unique human being is formed at the time of fertilization. Even before, this is how clear it is, even before the two nuclei of the sperm and of the egg unite, where there's still what we call pronuclei, but the sperm and the egg have united, already scientists can tell which end will be the head end and which will be the bottom end of that organism.
Wow.
And so, it's very, very early where things are determined. And so if it's not a human being at that point, when does it suddenly become a human being? At that point, it has all the genetic complement. It only needs the proper environment because it's a self-effectuating, self-activating organism at that point, and it's truly a human being and truly a human person. So that's not a religious opinion, that's just looking at the science and coming to a conclusion based on the science. And in fact, one of our speakers at the rally in front of the Supreme Court was an avowed atheist from Secular Pro-Life. There's an organization called Secular Pro-Life, and they tout themselves as atheists who have concluded that the pro-life position is the right position, that the embryo and the fetus need to be protected. So these are people who do not have religious views. They're stated, they're self-proclaimed atheists. And so that really blows Justice Sotomayor's argument out of the water. Yeah. We saw other signs suggesting the same thing, that there were people who normally wouldn't associate with the sort of the typical pro-life group. One sign I saw that said something, I'm a Democrat, I'm a lesbian, and I'm pro-life. And so these are not the usual people you associate with the pro-life group, and certainly she wasn't stating any kind of religious affiliation.
No.
So religion certainly does and can and should color our ethical choices and what we believe, but it's not a prerequisite, and this is not fundamentally a religious issue. This is fundamentally an issue of when life begins, and do we have the duty to protect all human life? And that is something that's grounded in the natural law, something that's written in everyone's heart, whether they're religious or not, and something upon which our republic is based. And that is, another speaker said, you know, the Constitution guarantees the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and they're in a certain order for a reason. And the first one is life, because that's the most important one, because without life, you can't have liberty. And then, of course, without liberty, you can't pursue happiness. Right. And so abortion takes away life and liberty from the preborn baby. But in many ways, it also takes away the life and liberty from a woman, because women feel like they have no other choice, so their liberty is taken. And so we have to realize that, go back to that, there are two victims of abortion, victimized by the medical abortion complex, and that's the preborn baby and the mother.
Dr. George Delgado is our guest, physician and ethicist. Your calls are very welcome. If you have a question about euthanasia or assisted suicide or palliative care at the end of life, Dr. Delgado is a palliative care physician and happy to talk with you about that. If you have questions about the beginnings of life, and maybe you have questions about the technologies, fertility technologies, those kinds of things, or a question about any stage of life where there are ethical questions that need answering about what is the most respectful and dignified way to treat each and every human life, you're welcome. If you disagree with us and you'd like to register your disagreement, you're also welcome. 888-318-7884 from right there in Washington, D.C., where one of the most important legal cases probably of the last century argued in Washington, D.C. today regarding abortion. Dr. George Delgado, our guest, your calls are welcome. 888-318-7884.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Calls coming in. Your call, welcome. 888-318-7884. In a minute here, we'll get some folks on the line with Dr. George Delgado, our guest. It's pro-life open forum. If you got a question about life in any stage, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you are welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Almost all of the pro-life arguments and explanations that we offer at any time are rooted in knowledge that's accessible to anyone, doesn't require revealed religion. So that's why I say, if you're not a Catholic or not a Christian or not, maybe not even a religious person, but you have a question about the proper treatment of human life in any of its stages, you're welcome. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We're still processing calls, so we'll get some folks on the line in a second. But Dr. Delgado, any other kind of pro-life news that you have taken note of that you'd like to, can I put them on the air? Okay. That you'd like to discuss before we go to the calls.
The Dobbs case, there's a question of viability that's coming up. Of course, that's kind of central to Roe v. Wade. And it was clear in Roe v. Wade that the justices said that really, I think they wrote something to the effect that we have no way of judging viability or when a person or a human organism is a human person. And so we're not going to deal with that. So that's where they picked viability as the line as to when states could regulate abortion. Well, it's clear that that's a line that moves as medical progress goes along. Back then, you know, viability was something like around 28 weeks, and now it's more like 22 weeks. And so just because we can take better care of a preterm baby, does that mean that somehow the value of the life changes? That makes no legal or common sense, actually. And so that'll be another issue that will be they'll try to settle or at least discuss it if they don't dodge it.
Yeah, it just seems that if you don't want to accept the science, you have to find some other place to go. I mean, this is 19th century science. The issue was settled in the 1870s about how conception happens. At least the basics were understood then. Certainly not the genetic part, but the how the sperm and egg formed the new child. But if you don't want to accept the science because you have an ideological reason for wanting to defend abortion, you got to make something up.
That's right. And that's what they did. They pulled a lot of things out of thin air, and it's time to correct all that.
Praise God. I hope but we're moving in the right direction, it does seem. Okay, here's how it's going to work, just so everybody knows. I'm going to put Dr. Delgado on hold while the caller asks the question, and then I'll put the caller on hold. So we won't be able to have a discussion because of the condition of the phones, but we'll at least get the question for Dr. Delgado. So I will go to Renee in Minnesota. Renee, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question comment is, at the moment of conception, when the sperm and the egg unite, there is a zinc spark that happens. This is something scientific that doctors and scientists have discovered. And with that zinc spark, some believe that it is the soul coming into the baby, the baby. So I'm wondering what your comment is on that and if you've heard of that.
All right. Thank you, Renee. Let me put Dr. Delgado on the line. Dr. Delgado, the zinc spark?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the zinc spark, but apparently it is something caused at the time of fertilization where zinc is released. And so you get a flooding of zinc. So I think that's more of a physical thing. And although I don't think it indicates that's when ensoulment takes place. However, it does happen at the same time as I think we should all believe that ensoulment takes place, because although from a Catholic perspective, the Church is not definitively stated that the soul is placed at the time of fertilization when the sperm and the egg unite. Pope John Paul wrote about this, and he suggested that, well, if it doesn't happen then when else would it happen? So that was a very strong suggestion in my mind. And from just a logical standpoint, if a human being is not a human person the entire time that human being is in existence, that just doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so I think we certainly can conclude that ensoulment does occur at the time of fertilization. The zinc spark does occur at the same time. I would opine that they are coincident, but not that one is necessarily directly related to the other. But they're coincident in that the physical occurs at the same time as the spiritual.
Renee,
that makes sense.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. The number again, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884, Pro-Life Open Forum with Dr. George Delgado on this day when Roe versus Wade came under a quite serious legal challenge today at the Supreme Court. But we don't have to talk about abortion. If you want to talk about life in any other stage, you want to talk about the proper treatment of life, maybe you have a relative who is in need of care and you are not sure, maybe the doctors are saying this or that, and you'd like some clarity on what the Church has to teach about that and what good moral reasoning has to teach about that, you're welcome to call 888 888- 888-318-7884 with your question. 888-318-7884. I wonder if your sense is, Dr. Delgado, that it seemed to me that there was some kind of admission in the kind of American law community that Roe was wrongly decided when the court decided not to do the same thing for euthanasia that they had done for abortion. And they didn't say, this is a private decision. They said, no, this is an issue for the states to decide. It's not for the court to decide. Do you think that that if we get a proper decision on Roe versus Wade, it may also roll back this, what seems to be a kind of a steamroller going forward on suicide and euthanasia?
I think it'll maybe cause, it will slow it down, because I think if and when Roe is reversed, that there'll be sort of a pause and maybe a national reflection, and that people may sort of collectively have a higher respect for life. I think that's what maybe will slow down this advancement of physician-assisted suicide. But I think though that issue is going to have to be, it's going to have to be met head on in the states, just like abortion will have to be met head on in the states at the same time, because what's happened there, and they are much more advanced, because the groups that are promoting physician-assisted suicide and later will promote euthanasia, because they are linked, definitely
sure.
They have established grassroots efforts that are fed by their national organization, Compassion and Choices, that used to be called the Hemlock Society. And so they focus on states that they think are vulnerable. They send a lot of resources there. They establish a grassroots, and they get going. So that will continue, but I think it'll be more difficult for them if there is a sort of a national reset and an increased level of awareness of the sanctity of life. So I think that will be the spillover, but probably not a direct effect.
Yeah, but that does speak to that we have to keep making these arguments. We have to keep reasoning with people whenever we have the opportunity to have these conversations.
Yes, absolutely, because you know we really need to change hearts, and the conversations on email or on social media or the old water cooler, they really do have an effect. People do listen to their peers and listen to their family, and so the better informed that people are, the better arguments they'll give, and the less they will rely on just emotional arguments based on simple personal experiences. So the family that has the grandmother suffering very much and has that sort of indelibly locked in their mind and wishing that she had had a way to end her life in a, quote, dignified fashion, will instead will say, well, you know, that wouldn't have been dignified, and hopefully she got good palliative care,
yeah,
and her symptoms were relieved, and we actually respected the dignity of her life by letting the life come to its natural conclusion instead of hastening her death.
It's Pro-Life Open Forum. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. Myra in Santa Rosa, California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are up next, Myra. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call.
Happy to.
I'm a philosophy student in the Bay Area, and I'm actually writing a paper this week on the moral status of fetuses and whether they're due any moral consideration. Obviously, I feel like it's self-evident that the fetus or the embryo, whatever word you'd like to use, is a living human being. However, it seems very unlikely to make the case from the appealing to scientific principles that they're due moral consideration. It seems like more of a philosophical arena. So I was wondering how you would make the argument that fetuses or embryos are persons and are due moral consideration.
Yeah, that's a great question, because you're right. That part of it is somewhat more in the realm of philosophy. So again, you go back to, when would you consider a human being to be a person? When would you recognize personhood? Because we don't grant personhood, right? That would be an erroneous conclusion to say that we, either as a government or as a society, can deem personhood. Personhood is something that is granted by the creator, or by, if you don't believe in a creator, by whoever or however that person became a person, then somehow personhood was granted. So really what we need to do is decide when can we acknowledge that the personhood exists for that human being. And so if you look at the, again, looking at the science, and you can look at that there's a continuum of development starting from the time of fertilization, and that then is called a zygote, a one-celled organism, then an embryo, then a fetus, then a newborn, then a child, then an adult, then a senescent adult.
Dr. Delgado, we got to finish the answer. Okay, there we go. All right, if you'll hang on, Myra, we really appreciate the call. We'll get a conclusion of Dr. Delgado's answer right after this. It's Pro-Life Open Forum. Your call's welcome, 888-318-7884.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Myra in Santa Rosa is on the line listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Got to write a paper to give a philosophical defense of the personhood of the unborn child. Dr. Delgado, you are in the midst of your answer to Myra.
So really it's a question of when we acknowledge that personhood exists. And if you look again at the developmental continuum, the sperm and the egg unite, there you have a unique organism, and that organism initially is called a zygote when it's one cell. Then when it's two cells, it's an embryo. Then when it's more developed, it's a fetus. When it's born, it's called a newborn. When it's older, it's called a toddler, then a child, then an adult, and finally a senescent or aging adult. So you have this entire continuum, and on what are you going to base personhood? Where are you going to draw that line? So are you going to do like some people and say until the person can survive outside of the womb? That's an arbitrary line because we've already talked about that can change and it has changed. Are you going to say when the person can think and has the cognitive abilities of most adult people? Well, what about the severely mentally retarded person? Is that person not a person? Or what about when dementia sets in? And the person can no longer think clearly and can no longer make decisions. Is that human being no longer a person? Clearly not. Clearly, it's that you have to apply and acknowledge personhood throughout the entire developmental continuum. And you have to acknowledge that wherever we are in that continuum, depending on where we are, we have different abilities and we have different levels of maturity and we have different levels of achieving our potential. And just because we haven't achieved our final potential does not mean that we are not persons. And just because we are past our peak potential does not mean we are no longer persons. That whole argument is fallacious. So clearly, I think you can argue that this human organism along this continuum, as long as you're a member of the human species, that you are a person, and that personhood goes along with being a human being from the time you start being a human being, that is fertilization, until the time of death.
Now, does that make sense to you, Myra?
Absolutely. So it's the most consistent definition of personhood is the one that grounds personhood in what the human being is, not in the human being's abilities. And so the constitution of like what defines a person isn't bound to like trivial definitions like what the person is capable of doing or what the human is capable of doing. So you've equipped me with a lot of tools for making my case. So thank you so much.
Myra, if I could ask you real quickly, once you get this philosophy degree, where are you going to work? Because we're looking for good, smart people to explain and defend the Catholic faith. Maybe you'll be available.
Wow. I would be honored to have a job. I don't have any plans yet. One of the difficult things about being a 23-year-old majoring in philosophy is it's kind of hard to like find a place in society where I can exercise my intellectual abilities.
Yeah, well, yeah, there are some people here at Catholic Answers who have intellectual abilities, and you could be one of them. Send us, it's none of the guys in the booth here, but yeah, send us an email. Send it to radio@catholic.com because you've explained it. I mean, you took what Dr. Delgado said, and I thought Dr. Delgado, she crystallized it really well.
I think so, too. And I would add something else that you just triggered a thought in my mind, Myra, and that would be that if you do base the acknowledgement of personhood based on abilities, what we would call that is ableism, and that's a discriminatory kind of action. And so you can see the ramifications of ableism is that you start to judge who's worthy of living, and that's exactly what got us on the road to Nazi Germany, where they started first killing mentally retarded babies with birth defects, and then, of course, they went to killing Jews and other people that were, quote, enemies of the state. So they're basing it on abilities is ableism, and that's a discriminatory kind of philosophy, and it doesn't make a lot of sense either.
Okay, Myra?
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much. Good luck on the paper. Hope it goes well. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. It's Pro-Life Open Forum. Every line full, so I better start moving quicker. Kathy in Cleveland, listening on The Rock, 1260 AM in Cleveland. Glad to have you, Kathy. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Delgado.
Thank you for taking my question. Specifically, define for me, please, doctor, natural death, if you could, particularly as it relates to the use of morphine relative to end of life.
Sure. So natural death is death that occurs because a person has a disease or has an accident and something happens that limits the organism's ability to live. That's a very simple definition. As far as morphine is a tool, and it's a very potent pain reliever, and it also helps with the sensation of shortness of breath. So it's a very effective and useful tool at the end of life, because at the end of life, when people are dying of, especially of chronic diseases, they have what I call the final common pathway symptoms. And these symptoms are they often develop pain and shortness of breath, amongst others. And morphine is very effective at relieving those symptoms. So we have a duty to provide relief to those patients, unless they refuse it, of course. And so morphine can be a very useful tool to alleviate the suffering of these people. Now, like other tools or medications that we use in medicine, there are the positive effects and there are side effects that can be negative. And morphine can have negative effects, particularly if it is used at excessive doses. So if it's used at heavy doses, then it can become a tool of destruction. It can be a tool of euthanasia, by overdosing someone with morphine, then you can end the life, then you're hastening death. And that, of course, is morally objectionable. Now, there may be a gray zone in there where you walk a tightrope, where you try to give enough morphine to alleviate symptoms and not cross that line and hasten death. Sometimes you're not sure where you're on that tightrope, and your intention is to relieve suffering, but you're using the morphine at doses where you foresee that there's a risk that you could hasten death, but there's no better way to alleviate the symptoms, and so you take that chance. And we invoke the principle of double effect there, where our intention is to do good, but sometimes the one action, giving the morphine carefully, can have an adverse effect of hastening death. In that case, then that would, if there's no better way to alleviate the suffering, then that would be deemed to be an acceptable risk, and we take those risks all the time. It's not a cavalier thing that we do, but it is something that we can, in good faith and utilizing good moral principles, can do that. Now, that is abused. I know that it is abused. I know people have called in about it, and I know I've read between the lines of medical records in the past where doctors have probably given higher doses than they should have. In the back of their minds, they really do want to hasten death, and that would essentially be euthanasia, and that, of course, is always morally wrong.
Does all that make sense to you, Kathy?
Yes, but do I have just one other second? And that is, Doctor, that you've just described my exact situation, and it was a matter of, we're going to give her morphine and to relieve some of the symptoms, and you just literally saw, you know, the heart monitor and the, you know, her heart rate continue and her blood pressure continued to drop, and then, you know, it was over. And, you know, as I witnessed this, I'm like, did I have a moral obligation to do more homework on this? Do I have a right, you know, heaven forbid I be put in that situation again, but do I have a right to be able to ask what is the appropriate dosage in order to avoid that?
Yes, absolutely. When you're the advocate for the patient, you know, whether it be a family member or friend, then you have the right to question the doctor and say, you know, I want to be clear that the dosages I want you to use are only dosages to relieve suffering. Now, I understand that there's some risk in using this medicine, but I want to make it perfectly clear that I don't want you to be crossing the line and purposely giving a higher dose than you really need to give, because we do not want to hasten death. And I think it's well within your purview and within your rights to do that, to make it absolutely clear that you want everyone to be on the right side of the ethical boundaries.
Kathy, it sounds like it sounds horrible what you witnessed, but it sounds like somebody did something in front of you that they didn't say that they were going to do. They said they were going to give morphine to relieve pain, and it sounds like they went beyond that.
Right, exactly. And at the time, I felt like I was at their mercy. And what could I do? And, you know, and literally, and, you know, I mean, and this has been something that I've carried, you know, in my conscience, that natural death, I viewed it as not natural death.
Right.
You know, and it was in a hospital setting. And, you know, and it, you know, and I've never really had a comfortable feeling that, you know, she passed naturally. So now the other thing is, and, you know, going back to the doctor's comment relative to comfort drugs or keeping her comfort, I guess I didn't see any physical distress in terms of pain. And I guess that should have been a better barometer. And that would be something that I would look at again in the future. If they're not physically, you know, expressing any discomfort, then maybe it isn't or shouldn't be an option.
Yes, and that's another good point. And you could ask, you know, what are the signs you're seeing? Because, you know, we're trained to look at different things when patients are not verbal to tell us if the patient is in pain. And we look for, especially for a furrowed brow. We look for facial grimacing. We look for limbs held tightly or inconsolability. And then we also look at for signs of shortness of breath. Fast breathing, working hard to breathe, those sorts of things. And so, you know, you certainly can question the doctor. And this is, you know, a collaborative effort between the advocate and the doctor or the nurse, and just say, you know, well, tell me what are you seeing that tells you that that my family member is having pain or is having shortness of breath? Tell me what you're seeing. And they should be able to explain that to you and give the justification for using that or any other medicine for that matter.
Kathy, I'm very grateful for your call. And we have to go because we have to do a very quick break. But I think that your call helped many, many people because we do need to have the information so that we can advocate for those, for ourselves and for others when we're in a medical situation like that. So I appreciate the very helpful question. It's a pro-life open forum. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. More questions for Dr. Delgado right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The world over with Rima DeRoyo. Coverage as seen through a Catholic lens.
All people of faith and sincerity need to awaken to this and protect this fundamental right of religious liberty.
Expert analysis.
Does revelation judge history or does history judge revelation?
Stories vital to people of faith.
It's part of our faith that comedy and tragedy naturally go hand in hand.
Delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up today. Go to EWTN.com/worldover.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, pro-life open forum this hour with Dr. George Delgado, the medical director of Culture of Life Families Practice here in San Diego, and a palliative care physician. And is the other, your other degree family medicine? Is that?
Yes, family medicine and hospice and palliative medicine.
Also, a well-trained ethicist, your questions are very welcome about, as you've been hearing, life at any stage, whether late in life, early in life, or when in crisis, anywhere in life. 888-318-7884. Coming right back home here to San Diego, listening on the Catholic Answers app, but could be listening on 1450 AM because we do have a Catholic radio station broadcasting EWTN nowadays here. Emily, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi. So I've been hearing stories lately about people who are pregnant with babies that are, you know, have some severe disorder that they're not going to survive long after birth. And a lot of them choose to do, like they call it, a termination for medical reasons. And some of them, they don't, they actually like give birth to the baby and but preterm. Say like around the age of viability or something like that. And I'm wondering, is that considered an abortion? Is it considered ethical from a Catholic point of view? Because I guess it seems like from a Catholic point of view, like if the...
Could I just get something?
Like baptize the baby while it's still alive, you know?
So Emily, the idea then is that the baby at some point during the pregnancy, the baby is diagnosed with a life-threatening or even a terminal condition. And so then how should we react when we get that diagnosis? Could, for example, the baby be delivered early? Am I getting the gist of what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's because I'm wondering if from a Catholic point of view, if you think if the baby may die in utero, would it be better to deliver the baby early so you could at least baptize it?
Oh,
or,
Emily.
Is that still considered like an abortion?
Fascinating question. Thank you. Dr. Delgado?
Yeah, that is a fascinating moral and theological question. The problem with that is that if you deliver, first of all, these prenatal diagnoses are not 100%. And I've seen many times when when doctors have given a prognosis and they've been wrong. In fact, just for example, today here in Washington, when one of the speakers, she was an elected representative, a congresswoman, she gave the story of her, she had a prenatal diagnosis of Potter syndrome, which is also known as agenesis of the kidneys. That is, the kidneys fail to form. And when this happens, there's no urine produced by the baby. And without the urine, there are very low levels of amniotic fluid. With low levels of amniotic fluid, the lungs don't develop. And so the doctors told her that the baby was sure to die, and they recommended termination. So another doctor might have recommended, well, preterm delivery, like you're suggesting. Well, it turned out that they did an innovative treatment that probably had been done before, where they infused saline into the uterus to mimic the amniotic fluid. The baby was born, and she didn't say, but probably have kidney transplants after birth and dialysis. And the baby grew up into a child, and the child was there with her today. So doctors were clearly wrong. So that's the first thing you have to, before you make a sort of irrevocable decision putting the mother into labor, then you want to make sure you're absolutely 100% right. And we never are 100% right. So even though you have this very good intention of wanting to baptize the child, I think that that's fraught with error because of that. There also could be complications to the woman because we know that a preterm delivery before 32 weeks increases a woman's future risk of breast cancer. And so even from a purely maternal-centric kind of reasoning, in many ways you'd want that pregnancy to go at least past 32 weeks to give that mother protection against breast cancer. So there's all of that. There also are situations where sometimes they deliver the baby before viability, and that essentially is a death sentence for the baby. And so that would be tantamount to an abortion. So that would not be medically indicated. So what, or justifiable from an ethical standpoint. So really from an ethical standpoint, really what can we justify is really the medical calculus of when does the baby do better outside of the womb compared to inside of the womb, and when is the pregnancy such a risk to the mother that you need to deliver early because the pregnancy is a risk to the mother. And that's not saying that we do an abortion to save the life of the mother, because that in itself is not ethically justifiable to take the life of the baby to preserve the life of the mother. But you can do is you can provide treatment to the mother for the complicating condition that you might foresee would end the life of the baby, and or risk ending the life of the baby, but you take that foreseen risk because you know there's no better way to treat the mother. This happens all the time, for example, with the case of tubal pregnancies, where a woman has a tubal pregnancy, and you foresee that if nothing is done, that the tube will rupture, and that would imperil the health of the mother and could lead to her death, very likely lead to her death. And so the affected tube is cut out in order to treat the mother. When in doing that, the secondary effect is that the life of the embryo is ended. And so that is justifiable. The other case would be, let's say if a woman had a cancer and you decided to go ahead and use a chemotherapy that you know could harm the baby, although parenthetically these days many chemotherapies can be chosen that don't harm the baby, but sometimes you don't have a choice. And so you choose that anyway, and you save the life of the mother, but you maybe harm the baby, or you even end the life of the baby by doing that chemotherapy. Or cancer of the uterus, where the uterus has to be removed, and in removing the uterus, baby comes out with the uterus, of course, and so you end the life of the baby. But that was not the direct action. The direct action was treating the mother's cancer. So in those cases, those are ethically justifiable. But I would not advocate inducing labor to prematurely deliver a baby in order for baptism. I think we'd be skating on very thin ethical ice. We don't know what happens to babies who die who have not received baptism, but the Catechism tells us that we do entrust them to the Lord, and we know that although they have original sin, they do not have actual personal sin because they've not yet reached the age of reason. So we sort of we hope on God's mercy and hope on there is the doctrine of baptism by intention, where we also entrust those people who are planning to be baptized, let's say, and get in a car accident before they're baptized. We entrust them to the mercy of the Lord. Well, this, I think, is an analogous case where we could assume that embryonic or fetal human person would have that intention deep down in the soul to be united with Christ and to be baptized.
Emily, I'm going to leave it there and say I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you for a fascinating question. I want to get to as many as I can before we have to go. We'll go now to Jay in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Jay, glad you're there. Can you be kind of quick with your question for Dr. Delgado?
Yes, certainly. Thanks for taking me. I'll try to be quick. How might you respond to someone who recognizes the personhood of a baby in utero, but still believes that the demands of pregnancy and childbirth, especially in the case of unintended, but in any case, believe that those demands still can justify ending the life of that child in utero?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to the value of the human person. And we know that if, let's say, there was already a born child in the house who suddenly came down with a severe illness and became a huge burden on the mother, then would you justify killing that already born child because of the burden? And this is in legal prudence, jurisprudence, they talk about the undue burden of pregnancy. Well, a person is never an undue burden. And as far as, except for the case of rape, the whole idea of unintended pregnancy, well, unless it was a rape, the woman intended to have intercourse and the man intended to have intercourse. And we all know that there are consequences to that. And unless it was forced upon you, you went into that willingly. And so really it was an intended action that had a possible consequence. And so you kind of have to take a look at it that way too. But even in the case of rape, it's a human person, and although if that human person is burdensome, you still do not have a right to kill that human person who is an innocent human person, just like you wouldn't have a right to kill an innocent human who was already born, who was a burden on the family.
Does that make sense to you, Jay?
It's very helpful. Wraps up everything I was hoping to get figured out. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for being so quick. You allowed another person to get their question in. Sandy in New York, listening on 89.9, you got to be really quick if you want to get an answer. We're just right up at the end.
Hi, doctor. On the heels of the morphine question, moral culpability based on your current understanding and training at the moment.
Oh, because you're concerned about Kathy. Yeah, go. I'm sorry, doctor. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I actually was going to mention that to Kathy, but we kind of ran out of time on her. And yeah, you're only culpable for what you know. And so she didn't know what was really going on there, and she trusted the doctor. So if they were acting in malfeasance and they did something wrong, she should not carry that on her conscience, because she did the best she could at the time with the knowledge she had for her family member. So that's all that God expects of us, is to do the best we can with what we know. And so, of course, we are required to inform our consciences and to inform ourselves, but that's all we're expected, is to do the best we can with what we know.
Sandy, I really appreciate the opportunity to get that clarification for Kathy. Thank you very much. Thanks to everybody who called. And Dr. Delgado, you got to everybody, so I'm very grateful. Thanks for being there representing the medical community, standing up for life in Washington, D.C. today, and thanks for everything you do for us.
Oh, it's a privilege. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And tomorrow, what do we got? 2 hours of open forum. I think it's Father Hugh. I think we got Father Hugh tomorrow. That's pretty good. That's pretty good for a Thursday. Got Father Hugh, 2 hours. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.